Hello and welcome to Seeing Jim. My name is Pauline Hamsey-Vinson, Interim Director of the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. The Seeing Jim podcast highlights the voices of contemporary Arab American writers. It is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and the Arab American National Museum. We open today's episode with Rida Talib reading from Noura's Extraordinary Superpower.
What's jail? What's prison? Is that where my Baba is? When is he coming back home? Noura asked with tears in her eyes. Jail or prison is where parents go sometimes when they break a law. Laws are like the rules we have in our classroom. For example, in our classroom, when a student breaks a rule, I might have to separate them from the class and place them in timeout for a while. Jail or prison is something like that. When a parent breaks a law, they might have to separate from their families for a while, the teacher continued. But that does not mean that he is a bad person or that he doesn't love you. He made a bad decision. We are still a family, and you may be wondering what it's like to be in prison, Mama said. It takes curiosity, imagination, and compassion in order to have empathy or understand the feelings of others. Even though you don't know exactly what it's like for Baba to be in prison, you can imagine what it must feel like for him to be separated from us right now, Mama said. I know how to imagine, just like I use my imagination to wonder what it must feel like to fly. Maybe Baba feels sad and misses us, just like I've been sad and missing him too, Noura said. Very good, Noura, Mama said. Does that mean that Baba won't be home today? Noura asked. Yes, it does, Habibti. Baba will be separated from us for a little longer, but he will be calling us this weekend, Mama said. She thanked the teacher for helping her to share the difficult news with Noura.
And I have the pleasure today to talk to Rida Talib about her book, Noura's Extraordinary Superpower, a book for youth with incarcerated loved ones and how to activate the inner superpower of empathy for healing. Rida is a native Detroiter and the proud daughter of Lebanese Muslim immigrants. She is a strategic transformative leader with a history of over 15 years of nonprofit experience that spans civic, legal, entrepreneurial, and social justice movements across the United States. Rida is the founder CEO of Dreamcatcher Innovations and serves a national clientele with nonprofit development and management, program design and implementation, strategy development and implementation, fundraising, social impact movement building, DEI advocacy, and community building. Rida also has her own podcast, Tahrir wal Harriya, Reimagining the Struggle for Collective Liberation. In Arabic, Tahrir means liberation and Harriya means freedom. Using the power of storytelling, Rida's podcast amplifies the impact of mass incarceration, the carceral state, and CVE policies on Arab Americans and Muslims, while also centering Islamophobia in the U.S. It is rooted in collective empathy, healing, and most importantly, joy. The podcast is a project of Futuro Media, and Rida was selected as one of 8 fellows for the Detroit Community Podcast Lab, which equips grassroots leaders with the skills and resources they need to successfully produce their own podcasts. Rida, I am so happy to say, is a graduate of the College of Arts, Sciences, and Letters at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, which is the host of the Seeing Jim podcast, and where I now have the pleasure of being the interim director for the Center of Arab American Studies. So it's a special pleasure to be talking to you today here about your work and about your book, Noura's Extraordinary Superpower. So Rida, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Peace to everyone listening. Assalamu alaikum to the whole community.
Very good. Thank you. So Rida, please tell us a little bit about your book, just to get an idea of what this book is about, what story it tells, what age group it's aimed at.
Sure. So the book is really about creating more community care and less cages. Specifically, it takes a deep dive into the journey of an Arab American Muslim girl named Noura, who is 6 years old. She notices that her father has been missing for quite some time, but doesn't really know where he is. And so through the book, readers can join her on her journey of actually discovering that her father has been incarcerated. Now, the family has not told her, obviously because of her age, but there reaches a climax in the story where Nuta is not able to be present at school. And so the teacher and her mom really work as a team to finally disclose to her where her father has been. And so the reader gets an understanding of what incarceration is. Specifically, youth who may have incarcerated parents really have an understanding of what incarceration is, what prison is. And the story does a great job of, again, just unpacking that in a digestible way for children. So the book is aimed for youth between 5 and 11 years old. So that would be K through fifth grade. However, we have been so warmed by the fact that youth even older than 11 years old have found this to be beneficial. Youth even in high school have shared really some of the transformational healing that they've experienced because they weren't really privy to this type of content or representation in books when they were younger as well.
Yeah, thank you. I definitely want to delve into the content of the book and the kindness and empathy that's really felt so strongly throughout this book. Before we get to the details, I would like to ask you if you'd like to share what motivated you to write this book.
Yes, thank you for the thoughtful question. When I was 6 years old, my father became incarcerated. And so the book is loosely based on mine and my family's lived experience. I really wanted to provide children with representation, a space and place in books where they can be seen, they can be valued, and they can be heard. And the illustrations really are representative of our community from a holistic perspective. You see an Arab American and Muslim family with a hijab imam who prays in the book early in the morning. She teaches her children how to pay attention when they're in school. And the book really emphasizes the significance of keeping the family intact as a unit. I was also motivated by the fact that, unfortunately, my family faced a lot of shame and stigma. There was a lack of resources, a lack of mental health support, a lack of religious leaders who were competent and who knew that they should be speaking about this topic to the community, whether it be at Salat al-Jumu'ah during Friday prayer, or just as a topic in general, because even back in the 80s, when my father first became incarcerated, we know that the opioid crisis was big then in this community. It just was sort of pushed under the rug, as they speak, and nobody was really, quote unquote, airing out the dirty laundry of the community. For many reasons. The reasoning behind it is to really give our children an opportunity to gain knowledge when something like this happens, to give them agency and ownership over their lives, and to equip them with healing and coping skills so that they don't feel shackled to this shame. And ultimately, we want to ensure that children from the MENA community and the Muslim community, respectively, have representation in books because we are severely lacking in that area as well.
That is so powerful and touching. And just for our listeners who may not know, MENA stands for Middle East and North African Communities. Thank you for sharing that background, because as a member of the Arab American community myself, I know that often it is, especially immigrant communities, it's very difficult to confront difficult topics, sensitive topics, because we are struggling with, you know, adjusting to a new place, new cultural acceptance, and there's a tendency to hide what we don't feel comfortable with, right? And there's this feeling of shame that comes in. But as you so powerfully talk about, we need to confront these issues because otherwise they're hurting us rather than our community helping us process and deal with them and work with them. So thank you so much for introducing these important topics to the community, Muslim and Arab American communities, at least the North African communities, which overlap in different ways, right?
Yeah.
That's such an important topic and fascinating. It doesn't come in here, but the way you connected to the opioid crisis as well. These taboo topics, these sensitive topics that we don't want to talk about. And you bring out this topic of incarceration and you do it so kindly and gently in this book. That's one of the things that struck me about it as a reader. There's so much gentleness in this book. I mean, yes, it's aimed at children, right?
Right.
So that comes through very clearly, but also the book cover, empathy is on Noura's t-shirt, right? She has a superhero cape and she's got empathy on it. And I love that because we don't think of empathy as a superheroic thing, right? We think of action.
Exactly.
Whereas this is such an emotional aspect of it. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship with your illustrator? The pictures in this are so beautiful and vibrant. There are a lot of smiling faces I noticed throughout. I mean, there are some tears as well that come in, but there's a lot of gentleness and smiling. Can you talk about the illustrator and the way you work together? And then also I want to talk to you about the editor, but let's talk about illustrator first.
Sure. So it took me some time to actually find the illustrator. Abira Das is just a brilliant creative who... I don't know if it was serendipitous or if it was our creator connecting us, creator with a big Z, connecting us together. But after really some diligence and research, I had found her on Instagram.
Oh, nice.
I was really touched by her intentionality in terms of the texture of the hair, the color of the hair, the shape of the eyes, the feature of the nose, the lips, and more importantly, the color of the skin. She was really able to cater to everything I asked her to do and went above and beyond to ensure that the representation was truly on point. So over a series of months, we would talk to each other virtually. She would send me some sketches. And I had put some really detailed notes in terms of the scenes in the book, the emotions that I wanted to be portrayed. And one of the things her and I talked about, in addition to our editor when building out the story, was to ensure that we showed a complex range of emotions, because human beings don't exist in a vacuum. And so that's the same for MENA folks as well, or Muslim families. And I really wanted children to understand that even though this was somewhat of a traumatic experience, the family as a whole remained loving and kind and forgiving and gentle with one another. And so we wanted to role model to the readers, to educators, to just really community members, what it means to have a snapshot into the lived experience of this family who happens to be Arab and Muslim, that our families are really just like any other American family. And in the home, that's our haven and our safe space where we experience laughter and joy and share food with one another and exchange cultural knowledge in terms of how to cope and heal when situations happen. But also, we wanted to illustrate that even though you may be experiencing a difficult time, or the circumstances that you're going through may seem that you cannot transcend them, that if you have daily rituals and daily routines in terms of cultivating joy and making sure that you are participating or engaging in activities such as gardening in the book.
Yes, that's what I was thinking of. I was going to just bring that up, that there's that beautiful scene of Noura gardening with her mother. It's in there. It seems like not really part of the plot, but so integral to the theme, right?
Yes.
That here, you know, she's not just crying and missing her dad, but she's also doing these, and not just the daily things of like eating and sleeping and all these.
And homework.
homework, which you show beautifully here. But also these small moments of gardening, these connections with her family and these life-giving moments, right? Gardening, planting, and all of that is so integral to that. These very touching moments in the book. Thank you for sharing the way you talked about the emotions that you wanted to convey with your illustrator, Abira Das. Because those shine through so beautifully in the illustrations as well.
Yes.
The expressions on the characters, there's a lot of kindness, there's a lot of smiling, but there's also the tears and the sadness and the concern that comes through very beautifully in these illustrations.
Yes, absolutely. And I wanted to segue back to the gardening illustrations. That was really intentional for us because it's just how I grew up. So both of my parents were gardeners and farmers back in Lebanon, in the southern part of Lebanon in Beit Jebel, where we're from. And so I wanted to tap into our ancestral and generational roots because we sort of take it to the dirt, if you will. And so I wanted to also role model for children to instill a sense of pride in who we are as a people, who we are as a community, that we are fruitful. And even in difficult moments where it may feel like a burial, it's really a planting and an opportunity to blossom into something greater. For children to utilize working their hands in the dirt as a metaphor for overcoming, and that even though you may plant a seed and bury it, if you wait and you're patient and you cultivate the earth and dirt around it, that it could become what it's destined to become, which is hopefully the highest potential of who our creator wants us to be.
Beautiful, beautiful. That's so lovely. And yes, there is a mention of that connection with Lebanon in the book, which comes through so naturally, and the way of what we bring from our backgrounds to our new spaces and how we carry that with us and how that also carries us in terms of sustaining us. And that's really beautiful in this book. One of the things that you mentioned is role models. And as I was reading the book, that really came through to me as an adult reader, you know, of the book, and sort of like it's almost like role modeling how we as adults, not just as children, but how the adults in the community can support somebody going through that experience. And not only the kindness of the mother and the love with the siblings, but also the teacher. Two things in particular struck me were the relaxation area in school and the sharing circle. And I thought, oh, I wish my kids had that in school. You know, what a great
idea. I wish I had that in school.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not even talking about me. I'm just, you know.
Right.
So talk to us about these two concepts, how you envision them in schools, and do they exist in certain schools? Or is that just sort of like a great, like, this is what we should have? So please talk to us about that.
Sure. So it's not just a hint of what I hope we can become in our classrooms. There are some spaces that, for example, have restorative justice practices and also have physical spaces in their classrooms dedicated to really catering to the whole child rather than just reinforcing rituals and activities and norms that expect children to come and perform in a very metric-centered way. We want to make sure that children have social-emotional learning throughout the school day, that they're connected to their identity, and that also in terms of critical skills building, for a child to be able to understand and name what they're feeling is important because then they can tie it to what they're experiencing. And ultimately, the goal is for our children to be knowledgeable in a way that perhaps if they want to grow up to be a community organizer or a community advocate, they could take their powerful, invaluable lived experience and connect it with certain policy that we might be working on and really bridge that gap and use it in a way that could better the community and take us forward in a direction we hope to be in terms of a more just and equitable world with less cages and more community care. Having specifically an area in the classroom dedicated to music, and you'll see in the book that the teacher is so gentle with Nuda.
Yes.
And I wanted to role model that because our educators deal with so much on a daily basis. And our children spend perhaps 75% of their day with them. So in many ways, our teachers are pseudo parents and caretakers for our children while they're also tasked with teaching them skills. So the dedicated space is really role modeling techniques that I was taught as a healing justice facilitator, where I approach from a trauma-informed lens, helping Arab Americans and Muslims who've been impacted by incarceration, how to really take it back to the basics. There's so much that you feel like you don't have control over when something traumatic like this happens. We just need to recenter ourselves, gain control of our breath. And the research I've done shows that if we learn how to take 4 deep breaths with some sort of cadence and really accompany that with some relaxing music, that physiologically, biologically, we can respond to what's happening outside of us in a way that is more peaceful, in a way that is more secure, and it creates safety for us. And it eases that pain and it allows us to really approach the situation where we're not always so anxious and stressed out and have heightened emotions. So we really wanted to make sure we put that in there, and also the art circle. So the concept of children even learning in a circle is something that resonates deeply with me, not just because I grew up in a family that had 8 kids, where we often sat and ate together in a circle, where we often had activities in a circle, but really it's a metaphor for life, that events in our lives are more so cyclical, not so much linear. And so mimicking and role modeling that in the classroom setting where everybody is on the same playing field, if you will, or everybody's at the same eye level. I really wanted to role model that as a way for educators to intentionally make sure that we're not always having a teacher in the front and then having children placed behind them, that everybody's in a circle together. And also my research has taught me Indigenous people also approach rituals and practices from this way. And that has been incredibly healing for me. So I'm deeply grateful to those Native Indigenous practices that I've incorporated into my own life and in my own body of work.
Thank you for sharing that. And lovely that you found such an organic way to put that in the book, bring in that training and that knowledge and that searching and those different forms of knowledge, Indigenous knowledges that you combine with Lebanese heritage and your background as a Muslim and all of these things that come together in this book beautifully. I wanted to ask you also, we talked about the illustrator. I want to talk to you about your editor. I know you have a closer relationship with your editor. Can you talk to us about that a little bit, please?
This is probably the most exciting question that you've asked me. So Enab is the African name of a beloved Detroit community elder and member, a civil rights icon, and her English name is Dr. Gloria House. So for those of you listening who may have matriculated U of M at the time I did, back in the early 2000s, Dr. Gloria House was an African-American professor here, and she was and remains to be one of the most inspirational human beings that I really have had the great honor of knowing. She's a mentor to me. She's a poet, and I hope she will be the next Poet Laureate of Detroit.
Nice.
She's also very well respected and known, not just in her community, but really across the country and the world. Her voice is so powerful, not just when you hear her recite some of her poetry, but when Gloria speaks, people listen. And her sharp and keen sense of putting words together, making sure that things are grammatically correct, is something I knew I needed to lean on. And there was no second guessing for me. There was only going to be one editor, and that would be her. So I was so privileged when she did graciously accept to edit my book. And I hope that she will be here to help me edit the rest of my books.
Nice. That's a beautiful tribute. Mm-hmm. And how amazing that you had the opportunity to study with her when you were a student and to be mentored by her after you graduated, that continuous relationship by an educator and a poet from the community who can bring her experience and her talent and her knowledge to pass it on and nurture your work. But that's lovely and a testament to the importance of the education, art, mentorship, cross-racial, inter-ethnic solidarity.
Absolutely.
Your work here embodies and that you're putting forward. So
yes. And Gloria also has extensive knowledge and experience in her own advocacy work with the topics of mass incarceration and just really collective liberation. So I knew I needed to tap into her wisdom, and because this is just the first in a series of books. So hopefully the readers will continue joining us, but you will ultimately see Nuta grow up and you will see who she becomes. So
beautiful.
We wanted to plant a seed for ensuring collective liberation and collective impact was built in from the beginning.
Yes, I really appreciate you emphasizing that, this idea of collective liberation, because none of us is alone in this world, right?
Correct.
And it's the interconnections are so important and the mutual support is so important. Thank you for sharing that. That's beautiful. Let's talk a little bit about some of the details in the book. So there are so many beautiful aspects of this book. There's, of course, the red bird. Can we talk about the red bird? And then we'll talk about some more of the other things. But the red bird is something that runs through the whole book from beginning to end. And it's a beautiful way that Noura connects with her father, mm-hmm. but also through her teachers and all of that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So the red bird, first and foremost, is a metaphor for freedom. So we really wanted to use that as a symbol to instill in children who can use their imagination, as you see Noura do. She is a very imaginative, curious little girl, and she's just mesmerized by these birds who have wings and physically look so different from her. As an empath, Noura likes to think about what it might feel like to fly instead of walk to school, for example. Yeah. So you see already touch points of this very creative, imaginative little girl who can then use her imagination and her curiosity to empathize with her father's situation, using art as a means of connecting a child to their parent who's incarcerated is very powerful. Number one, Noura has inherited this skill from her father. And so we wanted to make sure that we show folks who are incarcerated are still whole beings. They are not limited or defined by the worst moment in their life, that these are whole human beings who happen to make a mistake or a series of mistakes. And ultimately, they are paying the price for it, like my father did. But we wanted to show that children have the right and deserve to have their relationships with their parents intact. And that this is something that it's not just about our societal understanding of separating parents or people who commit crimes from their families as a means of punishment. We wanted to role model that if we are intentional enough, children as collateral consequences of these institutions, unfortunately, have the right to cultivate that relationship and to focus on really cool things that they have inherited from their parents. And that's something that myself as a creative, I did inherit from my father. And so I'm really grateful for the skills that I got from him in terms of my singing and my painting, even my spoken word. My father was very gifted. His voice was beautiful, whether it be when he would recite Quran or when he would sing. I have many stories of him that people had shared with me, where they would share that his voice was beautiful. And I have not very many, but some memories of his voice. And so I really wanted that to come through in terms of the bird. And you'll see towards the middle of the story where Noura is triggered during the art activity, she can't help but feel and remember her father because she's so proud that she can draw this bird because of him. Mm-hmm. And so it was important for the teacher to also at that time recognize and let her know that she should finish the activity because her father would be proud of her. Mm. Again, the teacher is aware and she is also intentionally making sure that that relationship is intact, that just because a person might be physically separated from you, that you're still emotionally and spiritually connected and that you are a part of who your parents are. So instilling that pride in children, in addition to obviously using it as a healing skill and activity.
Yes, that comes through so beautifully in your book, that there's an acknowledgement that that Noura's dad had done something wrong and that he takes responsibility for it. But the connection between Noura and her dad, they've shielded her from knowing. And then it's this way of gently explaining to her what's going on and how to keep that connection. And, you know, so often we have this idea that we need to ostracize.
Yes.
Right. And your book really works against that and shows the connection, the deep connection between Noura and her incarcerated dad.
Yes.
And the way that the mom doesn't foreclose that, mm-hmm. or, you know, we don't see anyone standing in the way of that, which is very beautiful in this book, making the whole aspect of it very natural and allowing the reader to accept it as well. That's a really beautiful aspect that comes through very nicely in your book.
Actually, you said something really important there. You said that the mom didn't really curtail that process. And I'm so blessed to have my mom because even in her own grief and in her own pain, becoming a single mother overnight, the third grade education, having not been here very long before my dad became incarcerated, I can't even really begin to imagine what it must have felt like for her. And even in those moments when she was visibly upset and hurt, rightfully so, with my father, my mom really allowed us to cultivate our own relationships with him. And I wanted to role model that in here in the book, because it wasn't until I got older that I started to really unpack the strength, the resilience, the emotional, spiritual maturity it must have taken for her to sort of move out of the way, as you so eloquently said, and to allow us to still glean and take those gifts from my father that he gave us in light of the tragedy of losing him and in the way that we did. And so I hope to role model that for any parents who might have a partner that may have committed something that caused them to be separated. I hope to role model that hopefully in their own healing journey, that they reach a point where they can also, as you so eloquently said, move out of the way and allow that relationship to still blossom.
Yeah, that's admirable for your mom, the way she had the presence of mind to do that and the strength to do that, because being faced with so much, as you said, without so much support, it takes a lot of inner strength. And so I can see that also you've inherited that from your mom as well as the art from your dad. So a beautiful combination that way. And in fact, one of the questions I was going to wait to ask, but maybe now is the better time to ask it, is how have your siblings and your mom, how has your family responded to this book? Have they seen it yet? And what are their responses? What was the process of writing it? Did you consult with them? Would you mind talking a little bit about that?
Sure. And thank you for the thoughtful question. Something that I did before even embarking on the book was, there was a really serendipitous moment back in 2019. I actually had hosted a criminal justice reform panel here at U of M Dearborn. And afterwards, some of us went to a poetry event hosted by Wayne State University. Professor Matthew Larson and his partner Leah put on that event. And that's where I had the just honor of meeting a gentleman named Daryl Woods Sr. When he took a look at me and heard my name, he said to me that he knew who I was. And I had never met this man before in my life. That encounter really became the foundation for a Spark Talk I ended up doing in Des Moines, Iowa, where I spoke about my father's incarceration publicly for the first time. I recall going back to that moment and understanding that this was really going to be my calling and my body of work. Mm-hmm. So taking it back all the way there, I hoped actually at the time that I could write the book then, because it was so ripe in my mind. But with the pandemic and everything closing down, there was just no way that that was going to happen. But I wanted to take it back and give some historical context to how I even wrote the book to begin with, because it is related to that event.
Nice. That's interesting, the sparks. Yeah. Has your family had a chance to read the book yet?
Interestingly, I actually asked my mom permission before I could share the story. And out of any other relationship for me, that was the most important, because nobody endured what she did. And as the matriarch and Meligar queen of our family, I wanted to make sure that she was okay with it. And I even spoke with her about what facets of the story she was okay with and what she wasn't okay with. So we came up with a meeting of the minds, if you will. And this is what we came up with together. In terms of my other siblings, there's only one sibling who is also aware of the book. But this interview and also the book is going to be a surprise for them over the holidays. So nobody else really knows about the story except for my mom and my oldest sister, Najwa.
Very nice. Beautiful. And I love the way you asked permission of your mom. I think that's so much respect and deep love and caring for her and for the strength of your relationship together. So
yes.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. And let's go back to the idea, because this is here, it connects to one of the main themes of the book, which is empathy. Mm. And you explain empathy so beautifully in the book. You tie it into the imagination. You talked about Noura's imagination. She imagines what it feels like for the bird to fly. Mm-hmm. And she says, I know how to imagine, just like I use my imagination to wonder what it must feel like to fly. Maybe Baba feels sad and misses us, just like I've been sad and missing him too. Mm-hmm. So there's that beautiful moment of connection, empathy through imagination, mm-hmm. that we can imagine what the other person feels given our experience. That becomes a way to kind of connect the two together. Can you talk a little bit more about that and the importance of empathy in your work?
Yes, absolutely. So it's really Noura's mom who defines that for her so beautifully in the book as well. So again, yes, we see the parent who in many situations may rightfully be overwhelmed and overcome with a situation and not be prepared to really share and exchange knowledge with her children, right? Because she's in survival mode, for example, busy putting food on the table, ensuring clothes on their back, just the day-to-day stuff, making sure her kids get to school and they're not taken away from her, for example, right? So here we see Noura's mom, in spite of everything she's going through, really holding it together and taking this opportunity as a teachable moment. That's that nurturing spirit that her mom is really bringing forth in the book. And so her mom tells her that it takes curiosity, imagination, and compassion in order to have empathy or understand the feelings of others. And the reason her mom is the best character in the book to share this, right? Yeah. It's because this is her mom. She knows her child.
Yeah.
And she has 7 other children. Yeah. So they all have distinct personalities, yes, and distinct skill sets and distinct unique gifts. And so we thought it would be best for her mom to share that with Noura and to educate her, in addition to the teacher who has already played a great role by allowing Noura opportunities to explore those emotions through art, mm-hmm, which is also aimed at helping children process their grief or their pain. And so empathy to me, Pauline, empathy begins as a feeling. And ultimately, empathy best realized goes from being a noun to a verb. Mm. Empathy at its highest potential allows us to take action. It allows us to stand in true, sincere solidarity with one another, irrespective of what we might be going through. And so you see already that the seeds have been planted in Noura's mind. And this idea of imagination and curiosity is so easy for children because that's just who they are. Mm-hmm. They haven't been clouded yet by social norms and perhaps certain activities or things that society places on us. So they're very pure in that sense. And I also loved how in the story, Noura is taught to trust her instincts and what she's feeling. Mm. Because I feel like that's something we don't teach girls, but also children in general. We always want to tell them how they should be feeling or tell them how to get over a situation. But here we've done the opposite. We're actually telling them to trust what they're feeling and we're helping them name what it is. And then we're framing it out in a way that they can ultimately have agency over those feelings and translate that again into an action rather than just a feeling.
The illustrations that accompany that section that we're talking about with empathy and imagination, mm-hmm, on one page, you have Noura and her teacher on either side of Noura, and they make a three of them. So the two, the teacher and the mother, and then Noura in between. And then the other one, it's the teacher, the mother, Noura, and one of her sisters. Mm-hmm. And the way that there is a kind of an embracing, right? A holding, mm-hmm, and a holding up, as it were, as well. That's really conveyed so beautifully in this. Back to the idea of role models, I feel like your book is also a role model for parenting, you know, teaching how to name emotions, teaching, you know, how to allow children to name and acknowledge their feelings, mm-hmm, you know, whether we come from Lebanese or Anglo-American backgrounds, Euro-American backgrounds. Those are things that until recently, people didn't really have the tools to do in the same way.
That's
I mean,
true.
Some people did them, but now we are finally talking about them mm-hmm. in a way that is naming them and acknowledging them in positive ways. So
yes.
thank you for including that as well, you know, as part of the healing. Mm-hmm. And this takes me to my final question for you, which is, you mentioned, you know, some of your other work, your spoken word work, but you also do a lot of other legal and civic and all these other things that you do. Can mm-hmm. you talk about how this book fits in with your larger work or how your larger work informs this book?
Sure. So the book is really a logical continuation of my decarceration advocacy work, which is also tied to my trauma-informed healing justice circles that I offer the community for free, thanks to a really generous grant. And so all of the activities, whether it be my spoken word poetry, the podcast, this book, or my decarceration advocacy with some comrades in New York and others across the country, where, for example, we're working right now on closing Rikers Island, which for those of you listening who may not know, is a complex of jails in New York. And unfortunately, 90% of people who are there are pretrial. So they haven't even really been convicted. And approximately 80% of them can't even afford cash bail. So we see how poverty really is a death sentence for some of these people who become incarcerated. And just this year alone, approximately 18 individuals have died at Rikers Island, either by suicide or some sort of lack of custody of care. Everything I do in this work, in this space, is really aimed at amplifying what is going on in this country in terms of our complete obsession with punishment, perpetuating that. And not really understanding that we have to create alternatives to that punishment. And that requires us to shift funding, for example, towards programming that actually works in our communities. And specifically for our two respective communities represented here, Arab American and Muslim, we know that as Arab Americans, especially here in Dearborn, we do have an opioid crisis. And a lot of people are still very scared to talk about that, to say that they need help. And it's not just those individuals who are being harmed. It's really the entire family unit that's being harmed. And because of that, the community suffers as well. So there's a real trickle-down effect to what's happening when individuals are not given the equitable resources they need to help with any ailment or illness that they might be having. Another thing that I would say that's important about my work is really taking away the stigma and the shame that my family really dealt with for decades, not just years, but decades, and making sure that when we make it safe for people to come together, that they can experience communal care. Because one of the lessons I've learned in my own journey is that as an individual, you can only heal so much alone. But healing in its highest form takes place in a communal setting. And so we have to keep talking about this. We have to make sure that we're requesting the help we need. And also tying that to the erasure of our community on a federal level, we still don't have a box on the census. In addition to that, because of that erasure, we see that even MENA folks that are incarcerated, the Department of Corrections is not obligated to track us in that way. So we don't even have a box even when we're incarcerated. And so there's just so much compounded that we deal with as a community, but really wanting to ensure that when we are centering the most marginalized within us, when we create with and for them, really everybody benefits from that. And we are only as strong as our quote unquote weakest link. So we have to learn how to uplift and as we climb, reach for others and create spaces and places for Arabs and Muslims to really feel welcomed as their whole selves. And to also make sure that we are stressing the importance of mental health support. The CDC defines something called adverse childhood experiences. One of those experiences is having an incarcerated parent. So imagine now taking the other factors that they list, stacking them up against each other, and you really see a compound complex issue where children that have incarcerated parents, really their whole quality of life is now harmed. And ultimately, many of us who have incarcerated parents are thrust into poverty. We don't receive mental health support. We don't have the communal care that we should be receiving, and a host of other issues, right? So wanting to really just tie that all together and make sure that our children and other folks touched by this system have an opportunity to share their individual stories, not just for their own healing, reclaiming their joy and being whole people, but also because it is inevitably when one person shares their story, we give permission for others to do the same.
So true. Thank you for your courage in taking your personal story and connecting it to community and expanding your sense of community. And thank you for the role modeling that you do in this beautiful book for both adults and children, and for foregrounding issues that many are reluctant to talk about. You're opening that door to that conversation, to inviting others to join in this conversation and hopefully to the journey of healing, because that is something that comes through so beautifully in the book and so beautifully in the way you talk about your experiences, that aspect of healing, individual and community healing. And I was really touched by the way you talk about the paying attention to the most marginalized.
Yes.
As a way to uplift everybody, right? Mm-hmm. And that is so true. And that is something that we often forget, right? So thank you so much for this really amazing conversation. Thank you for this book. And I look forward to the other others that will follow.
Yeah, stay tuned. And I would just like to say, go blue.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's episode was hosted by Pauline Homsi Vincent. It was produced by Muhammad Jafar and Asma Baban, and edited by Muhammad Jafar. Our theme song was composed by Isra Darwish, and our logo was created by Maisara Abdul Haq. Scene Jim is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn and the Arab American National Museum. Scene Jim is funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn. Check out our website, scenegmpodcast.org, for more information on our guests and to view videos of their readings. Thank you for listening.